You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
So this is The Brian Callen Hunter Mott Show. And Hunter, talk to us about what you're looking up right now. So we're waiting for Jonah Berger, who wrote a great book called Contagious, Why Things Catch On, What Makes Things Popular. He's a Wharton professor, and it's a fascinating book. I can't wait to get involved in this. He's going to call in. I was a little late. So we told him to wait. Muktuk? You were talking about Muktuk?
Yes, Muktuk, which is it's also known as Inuit or Eskimo ice cream sometimes. Mm. And it's usually made of frozen whale blubber and frozen whale skin and blubber.
Delicious. My mouth is already watering.
And I believe that it also, you know, much like, you know, sort of Western ice cream, it often comes in flavors, like they'll mix in berries.
So berries from the tundra, from the Arctic?
Yeah, exactly. Mm. Seasonal berries and whale blubber.
Wow. That's delicious. So it's actually ice cream you can chew.
Yeah. I mean, the interesting thing is, I mean, you know, apparently the skin is supposed to be frozen.
Right, of course, well, duh.
So, I mean, you know, that's probably why they call it Eskimo ice cream. I'm always fascinated by things that they call, like, when they talk about, like, Japanese pizza.
Yeah.
Right? And
first of all, Eskimo is considered politically incorrect. It's Inuit. Well, Dave Attell has a joke where he's like, I'm a racist, but I'm a unique racist. I hate Eskimos. I hold rallies, and it's like, down with Nanook.
Well, I mean, joke. Eskimo is just sort of a larger category that includes the Inuit and the Yupik. And then the Aleut, as in the Aleutian Islands, are closely related, but I don't know if they would fall under... The term Eskimo has fallen out of favor as pejorative and has widely been replaced by the term Inuit. But we shouldn't just call everybody from that part of the world Inuit, because that's just one tribe.
I can't keep up. I can't keep up with the politically correct army. They're even protecting the rights of the Inuit / Eskimo. My problem with the politically correct movement is that... I think they point their guns in the wrong direction. I think a lot of times they attack good people. Alec Baldwin called a paparazzi guy a cocksucker, and apparently that made him homophobic. And when people – and they attacked him. And Alec Baldwin's the farthest thing from a homophobe. In fact, Alec Baldwin's done a lot of things for gay rights and believes in them and is a very kind of left-of-center guy who's a very inclusive person. I don't really necessarily agree with his politics, but the one thing you can't say about Alec Baldwin is that he's homophobic. And they really railroaded him, man. Mm-hmm. And it's just the lunatic fringe and people who are not doing – they're not doing anybody a service. They're certainly not doing – if they're trying to defend gay rights, they're not doing that person any – and they're not doing that group of people – any favors.
They're also being extremists. They're not creating an environment for an actual conversation.
No, they're being unfair. It's my problem with the PETA people. They come after people for, you know, I think it was Charlize Theron who was talking about how AIDS research should be done on animals if it's going to save lives, you know. Mm-hmm. Oh my God, you know, she hates animals. And well, when you do that, you lose people like me. Right. I'm not going to support you. I don't think you're fair. I don't think you're very fair. I think you're being unfair. Jonah Berger.
Yes.
Brian Callen, sir, sorry to keep an esteemed leader of thought like yourself waiting. We are recording, by the way. We've been talking about you.
And about Muktuk.
And about whale blubber and mixed berries. So that's how we pass the time.
Okay. Good to hear.
Yes, sir. First of all, I loved your book. And I want to start by just sort of, I guess, kissing your ass a little bit, because I just find people like you, when you take a subject I've long been fascinated by. Why do some restaurants, why are they popular, others are not? Why do some YouTube videos go viral? I mean, I'm a comedian. You know, I'm constantly thinking about how I can sell tickets and get people out to see me. And you know, sometimes things catch on. And looking at the amount of research and the effort that went into this, you came up with an answer. And what I find so fascinating about the book is it differs from The Tipping Point, which you talk about a lot in the book, Malcolm Gladwell's book, because Malcolm Gladwell talks about in The Tipping Point the groups of people that are responsible for how things catch on. But in your book, Contagious, Why Things Catch On, You get even deeper into human psychology and how our brains work and why certain things catch on and others don't. And you break it into six steps. And that's all I wanted to say. And then we just let you go. That was a long intro, man. I'm just excited. I'm excited to have you on the line.
A long and very nice intro. I appreciate it. And I think to your point, whether you're you have your own small business, you're an entrepreneur, you're a larger company, you're a manager at a big organization, we all want our stuff to catch on, whether it's a product, we have a new product or service, whether it's an idea within our organizations, whether we have a piece of online content that we want to be distributed. We all see things catch on, Greek yogurt at the grocery store, a certain movie becoming popular, a certain news article pinging around the web and catching fire. And we often think that it's random or luck, that it's like chance why these things
happen. I always did until I read the book. Yeah.
And I think, it's easy to think that, right? It's easy to think that it's just random and there's no structure to it. And I don't mean to suggest that, we can perfectly 100% of the time pick exactly the amount of views that a piece of content will get. But we can reliably say, just like a recipe, you add certain ingredients to your content, you build certain ingredients into your products, your messages, your marketing, and you'll get, 30%, 40% or more word of mouth by understanding why people talk and share.
And without giving away too much of the book, because I promise you this is one of the books I'm going to recommend the shit out of. It's like one of my favorite things to do. When I read a book like this, you're like, did you like The Tipping Point? Check out Jonah Berger's book, Contagious. Again, I'm doing what you talk about. It makes me feel like an insider. I've got privy information. I've got social currency. Because not only did I read the book, but I also kind of know Jonah Berger. this is part of how human beings behave, and this is how things get. You were talking about how they sent you a book one time, a publisher, but they sent you two books of the same copy. And you said, "What? This doesn't make sense." Well, they were targeting you. They were saying, Jonah Berger probably knows other people that will talk about this book, and things catch on through word of mouth.
But also, part of what you were also saying is that the difference between being sent a book by a publisher and being given it by someone you know is huge. There's so much more currency socially, right, if it's coming from somebody that you know. Like, it has a personal endorsement.
Oh, certainly. And the big power of word of mouth is we trust it much more than messages that come from companies. Companies will always say, my product is the best. My service is fantastic. Check out my content. It's great. No one ever says, our service is like the 16th best service in the industry. we have the 7th best product. These other guys make much better products than we do. Go see them first. And if they're busy, come see us. Everybody says they're great, so we don't know whether to believe them or not. But if our friend says, hey, this is really good, a friend listens to your show, they say, hey, it's awesome. I love it. It was really funny, really engaging. You're much more likely to check it out. And as a result, word of mouth has over 10 times the impact as traditional advertising.
And there are some interesting statistics in the book about, we think that, social media, the internet, all of that sort of stuff is utterly transforming things, but it seems to mostly still be word of mouth is the most powerful.
Well, that kind of blew my mind. When you 7%, I think you said 7% of information is exchanged online, whereas we still interact a great deal without using our phones and our computers.
Yes, and I think that is particularly amazing to most people. We think that word of mouth is all about online, right? It's all about social media. It's all about being on Twitter and having a lot of followers and being on Facebook. Hardly a day goes by without some article being written in a major newspaper about how word of mouth and social media are taking over the world. Social media is a useful channel for word of mouth, but it is only one of the channels that word of mouth is spread through. It's not the only one. Most word of mouth is offline. Over 80% of word of mouth is offline. And so for me, it's not just about, hey, can I use these technologies? Can I collect more friends on Facebook or more followers on Twitter so I feel like I'm cool? But can I really get people to share my stuff? At the end of the day, whether online or offline, can I turn those customers into advocates? You're a comedian. You know this. Someone comes to your show and loves it and tells someone else, hey, it's really funny, or tells one of your jokes and tells somebody else, and they like it, they'll go check you out. It's how do we take the people that already like us and get them to spread the word?
That's truly how you build an audience. I was just talking to my agent about this, and now, maybe the podcast, but mainly it's kind of been nice because I've been doing this so long that now I start to sell out. And usually you can tell the mark of a comedian is if you can sell it on a Thursday or a Sunday. And that seems to be happening after all this time. But I was talking to my agent. I said, yeah, I've been doing the podcast. And my agent said, it's not the pod. He said, that's very helpful. He said, but you've been coming back to these markets. And if you keep delivering and you keep coming up with new material, people will come back and they tell their friends. And you can usually tell on a Thursday, if you're doing your job on a Thursday, you're supposed to end with even more people on a Sunday. And that's because they've been talking to each other and they tell their friends and their friends come. So I live that every single day.
And what I love about that example is if your jokes are really funny, mm-hmm. people will tell them to other people, and it makes them look good because they're telling the joke, but it'll drive people back to you. It's not that they're really influential people necessarily. They have the most friends or the most followers, but some jokes are really funny regardless of who tells them. And it's the same thing that I talk about in Contagious, right? You want to make sure, is your message spreadable enough? Is your message talkable enough that whether someone has 10 friends or 10,000, they'll pass it on, whether it's to make them look good or tell a story or all these other factors that I talk about. And at the end of the day, that helps carry you along for the ride.
Part of what I loved about the book as well is that, you know, when you look at the movement of ideas purely from the perspective of technology, it does seem to be sort of random, right? All these people put up their articles. Some of them take off. Some of them don't. Like, it must just be the luck of the draw. But when you look in terms of human nature, you start to realize, oh, it's not random at all. Like, some of these messages are fun to talk about. Some of them, you know, have all of these steps that, you know, you're talking about that we'll go through. But from the perspective of human nature, you realize it's not random at all.
Yeah, and I mean, just like certain factors shape our purchase decisions, shape who we end up marrying or who we end up liking, there's even some great research now on what makes things funny, right? These things can be broken down into principles that reliably drive what happens.
So let's talk about, I mean, you've laid out this acronym, right? STEPS, which is the six things that really you've found in the research make a difference in what drive people to talk and share. Would you mind telling us the BlendTech story?
Yeah. So the BlendTech story is a pretty funny one. So there's a blender. It's called BlendTech. They make a really powerful blender. And that's not how they got attention, though. They got attention through a great set of videos. So this guy walks into an office. His first day in the office is a marketing guy. Walks in and notices a pile of sawdust on the floor. And he goes to one of his colleagues, you know, why is there sawdust on the floor? What's going on? Are we expanding the company? His coworker goes, no, not expanding the company. Actually, the CEO is doing what he tries to do every day, which is break blenders. So the CEO would take 2x4 pieces of wood, he'd take golf balls, he'd take big lighters, pens, really whatever he could find, stuff them in the blender to see if the blender was tough enough to cut it, trying to make a really tough blender. Now, the guy saw this, the marketing guy, said, wow, this is going to be a viral home run. So he took a $50 marketing budget, not $50 million, not $50,000, but $50, videotaped his CEO doing what his CEO was already doing, right, blending stuff, trying to cut up iPhones in the blender, and put them online. A clip I often show is one of an iPhone. You watch an iPhone get torn to shreds in a blender. It's amazing to watch. It's crazy. Videos over 10 million views. The set of videos has over 200 million. Blender sales go up over 700% when these things come out.
God.
And that's huge, right? A 700% sales increase, anyone would be happy with that. But to me, that's actually not the most remarkable part. The most remarkable part is they did this for one of the least exciting products ever. They did this for a blender, right? Something
crazy.
You think no one would talk about.
Right.
Because it's not about something being born remarkable. It's not, oh, you know, if your product's naturally remarkable, people will talk. If not, you're doomed to fail. It's about finding that inner remarkability, right? How can you show people rather than tell them what's so remarkable about what you're doing and use that to grow?
Well, I mean, look at the McRib, your example of basically it's tripe, which is stomach lining. And then it's belly meat. And what is the other product in McRibs?
There's definitely a lot of barbecue sauce on top, but it is a lot of less desirable parts of the pig.
Yeah, not good stuff. I want some pig stomach. I'd like some pig belly, or actually stomach, and then pig inside of the pig. And then there's one other thing. But yeah, make it scarce. Make it scarce. And throw a lot of barbecue sauce on it, and all of a sudden people want it really badly. So that people want to feel like they are the ones who they're the insider. They are the ones who get this. They're part of an exclusive club. And I think Ayn Rand, or Ayn Rand, however you want to say her name, she talked about this with modern art. Modern art, I mean, when Rauschenberg would put a broom or a mop in a bucket and put it against a wall and say that's art. Well, the reason that kind of stuff would catch on was because there was a small group of people that felt like they wanted to be the elite that actually got it.
Mm-hmm.
They were so sophisticated, they got this stuff. And that was a large, that sentiment or that human drive was what, I guess, made people like Rauschenberg a lot of money. I mean, I don't want to be too unfair to Rauschenberg. I'm sure he had this, but.
But I think, you know, too often we think about ourselves. Right, as when we're trying to get our ideas out, we think about us, we talk about us, we sell us. And the question is, how can we get our stuff to be shared by making our audience look good? Right? How can we make them look smart and in the know and make them want to spread the word about us as a way to do that? Mm-hmm. Because in doing that, people will talk about us and we'll come along for the ride.
Well, with you, so let me ask you this. You've taken on this, it was a pretty ambitious plan. You've succeeded. You write this great book. You figure out, you know, how the human brain works to an extent, at least in terms of how we relate to, you know, products and what we you know, latch onto. Do you find yourself, I guess, now that you're aware of how you behave, do you find yourself pushing back against that? Or do you just kind of give into it? It's a weird question, but I just...
No, but it totally makes sense. You know, I wish I could say that I'm somehow immune to this, that being aware of it somehow makes us immune to this. But this isn't just like a hat we put on, you know, when we're buying a product, or a hat we put on, like, today I'm going to put on my word of mouth hat. You know, word of mouth is embedded in everything we do on a daily basis. You know, when we're done with this show, we'll probably chat a little bit. You guys will go on with your day. You'll talk to somebody. I'll do the same. We don't interrupt our daily life to talk. It's part of what we do. And so these psychological factors drive what when we talk about products, but also the stories we share, the rumors we pass along, and the information that we talk about. And so being aware of it, sometimes I see it and I sort of laugh. You know, I notice myself doing it. This social currency idea, you see it all the time with humble bragging, right? People want to tell others how great they are, but they don't want to seem like they're bragging.
Right.
So they'll say, well, okay, I couch my brag in a little bit of a nick against myself. So, you know, oh God, you know, I'm interviewing with you guys today. You know, I hope I don't make a fool of myself. And really what I'm saying is, look at me, I'm on this show. Isn't that great? But I add that so it doesn't seem like I'm bragging. We do this all the time,
yeah.
but we don't always realize it.
Yeah, that's right. Well, can you explain to me, since you study this, why you think trends, clothing trends, fashion trends start and stop, and who is responsible for that? Is it the same? Can we apply the same principles to that as we can to say why certain candidates get elected?
Yeah, you know, I think there's some similarities. There's also some differences. With fashion, it's really a lot about how we look to others, right? So, you know, sure, we wear clothes because they keep us warm, but we also wear clothes because they make us look like certain people. And, you know, most of us don't want to necessarily be the first person to be doing something. We may not care if we're ahead of the curve, but we definitely don't want to be way behind the curve. So we adopt things to help us fit in and to help us, you know, do what others are doing. If our clothes are, you know, hopelessly out of fashion, we move on to something new. And so part of it's the symbolic meaning, right? What it signals to wear a certain style of clothes, just like what it signals to drive a particular type of car.
The other question that I had for you as well is, you know, in terms of the gossip thing, I mean, I think so much of what, you know, all of the neuroscience and all of the psychology that's coming out is it just makes us more comfortable with and more honest with who we are, right? I mean, it's like, this is who we are. Like, we can just get on with it, accept it, and move forward. Right.
But I think that's a great way to think about it. You know, sometimes you think, oh, you know, this is not, no one wants to say it's them. Oh, you know, I don't do this. We all do these things. It's the way we work as individuals. It's the way we're built. And understanding that can help us have better and more fulfilling lives.
And we can now start to design messages that are better suited towards human beings, because so often, you know, we feel frustrated because, you know, we try and get people excited about campaign finance or global warming or whatever it may be. And then, you know, we inundate with them with a bunch of statistics and then they don't respond. And it's easy to see that as like, human beings are, you know, they're just not interested in
ideas.
They're
irrational.
Exactly. They're irrational. Yeah. It becomes this sort of thing where you start blaming the customer rather than recognizing, oh, no, the failure is on me because I haven't actually designed a message. Like, what are my real reasons for being excited about ideas? It's because I feel like I'm part of this cool club that knows these things. And then the ideas have to be packaged. So it's like, hey, guys, here's an opportunity for you to look good rather than it being about, as you said, about me.
Yep. It's so easy to blame the audience. You know, when things don't go the way we hope, it's like, oh, they didn't get it. And it's like, well, take a step back and think about what can you do by understanding them to help increase the chance they'll get it in the future.
Yeah, there's I wanted to ask you as well. There's a book by Everett Rogers called The Diffusion of Innovations.
Yes.
Which is, you know, sort of, I mean, the
I like the way Jonah said that.
Yes.
He knows the book.
I have a top 5 book or a top 7 book list, and that is in there.
Yeah.
Really?
That's one of my favorites. Yeah, great book.
Damn.
It's an awesome book. And, you know, I mean, it's sort of, in many ways, it's the intellectual precursor to your book. I mean, much less accessible than Contagious is.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you know, some of the, that was such an eye-opener and so awakening for me because, you know, the book opens with talking about scurvy, right? Where we often think that innovations succeed on their own merits, right? And you can't get any simpler intervention than fixing scurvy by, like, giving people a lime.
Yeah.
And yet it took about 200 years for that to catch on.
God.
200 years. And, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's funny you mention that. I just today was my last day of class. I'm teaching a group of tech entrepreneurs, and one thing I always, you know, talk about is think less about the technology and how high quality it is and whether it works, and more about the psychology. Who's the end user? How can you be user focused rather than product focused? That scurvy example is perfect, right? Something's high quality, it'll help you, make you better off, yet it doesn't catch on because
right.
It's not that things catch on just because they're useful. They catch on based on why people talk and share.
Well, it's emotional, Jonah, isn't it? I mean, my God, when you try to get people to eat better, I was talking to my friend, having an argument. He was saying that he was supporting Bloomberg's idea that there should be no trans fats in foods. And I said, problem with the government legislating that kind of stuff is that people know what's good and bad for them. They don't eat things because it's rationally good or bad. My God, yeah. We were with a bunch of college educated people that all of them were smoking. And I said, they all know that this is probably going to cause cancer. They're not being rational about it, you know? Do you find that all the time? I mean, it's really an emotional issue.
Oh, certainly. So we did some work trying to get people to make healthier choices, similar to what you're talking about. You know, it's not that people eat fatty food or smoke because they think it's good for them. It's about, you know, the identity it communicates or the emotional benefit. So we did some things where we changed the identity associated with different sorts of foods or different behaviors. So, for example, we associated eating junk food with an identity people didn't want to be associated with, mm-hmm. made them much less likely to eat junk food,
mm-hmm.
right? If you think about junk food as communicating identity you don't want it to communicate, you're going to be less likely to do it because you're not eating it because you're like, oh, rationally it's the right thing to do. You're eating because it tastes good. And so we need to pull on a different lever to change behavior.
So it becomes about membership in a club, basically.
It becomes about membership in a club. What it signals about you. You know,
yeah.
Just like when you drive a car, you put on some clothes. What does it say about you to wear, to say a certain thing, to pass on a piece of content, or to engage in a certain behavior?
I just think the book is so relevant to everything in a way, like just my relationship and how you get somebody to... how many arguments do you see, especially with guys? They just start shouting their point of view, and then they try to sell it to you. And nobody's really listening to each other. Whereas, or my God, and if you're with your wife or, you know, your husband and you're trying to get a point across, you have your stated, you know, philosophy here. It's you could use a lot of the principles in this book to kind of get to somebody, I think.
Certainly, yeah. And these are the same principles that drive what people share, but also the decisions they make. You know, triggers, the next thing in the framework, shapes all types of decisions, not just what we share. It shapes what we purchase and even who we vote for.
Yeah, can you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. So, you know, my favorite example of triggers, I think we all know the Geico Hump Day ad from this past year. So Camel walking through an office going, what day is it today, guys? What day is it? What day is it? Finally finds this poor woman. She goes, it's hump day. The Camel gets really excited. The ad goes, you know, how happy are people who save money with Geico? Happier than a Camel on Wednesday. Wednesday's hump day. People love the ad. You know, pretty funny.
I didn't see that, but it's
yeah,
great.
It's brilliant. Yeah.
Oh, you haven't seen it? Yeah,
no, I love that.
It's funny. It's not that funny, but it's sort of funny.
Yeah.
But what's neat is when you look at the share data of that ad, and that ad is the second most shared ad of last year. And so it's good, but it's not amazing yet. It's done extremely well. And so one thing you might wonder is why, right? Why did so many people share this piece of content? Well, if you look at the data, you see an interesting pattern. There'll be a spike, and then it goes down, and then another spike, and then it goes down, another spike, and then it goes down. You look closer, the spikes aren't random. They're 7 days apart. And if you look even closer, you'll notice that they're every Wednesday, or as it's colloquially known, hump day,
yeah.
Right? And so this ad is equally good or bad every day of the week. It's the same thing on Monday, same on Tuesday, but Wednesday rolls around, and it provides a ready reminder, what psychologists would call a trigger, to make people think about it and talk about it and share it. Because if something's top of mind, it's much more likely to be tip of tongue. It's not just how much we like something, it's whether we're thinking about it or not.
Man, I can just see your book being passed around by CEOs to all the employees.
But also, I mean, I think actually the sector that needs it most, because listen, I mean, CEOs will be smart about marketing and, you know, they'll follow the dollar. I think the community that needs it most is the nonprofit sector, because that's, I mean, you know, particularly in education, you know, that's where I spend a lot of my time. And very often, you know, there's this idea that like education is good for you. It's vegetables. You should like it. And then it just sort of is like thrown at people. And then it's like, talk about blaming the audience. Like, why are the kids not interested? Why are they not engaged? Or, you know, spreading messages like global warming or campaign finance. I mean, the nonprofit sector is really the one that tends to blame the audience.
I think that point is so important. You know, I often, when I talk to people about these ideas, I ask them to make a simple choice. You know, which is tastier, broccoli or a cheeseburger? And that's a no-brainer, right? Everybody would say a cheeseburger, unless you're vegetarian or you really, really like vegetables.
Yeah, unless you're lying to yourself. Yeah,
yeah, or a liar, one or the other, right? You're vegetarian, you're a liar. Yeah. But so the question is, well, what do you do then if you're broccoli, right? If you got something really good, too often we sit there, particularly in the nonprofit community, we're broccoli. We say, oh, we're good for everybody. People should eat more of us. This is what people should be doing. If we just tell them we have lots of vitamin C and fiber, they'll do it. And meanwhile, people keep chomping away on the cheeseburgers and the fries. And it's not random or luck, right? It's based on the way our stomachs and our tongues are built. Certain things are tastier than others. We need to do the same thing with messages. We need to think about how can we make our messages tastier, not by understanding people's tongues or their stomachs, but by understanding how their minds work.
And understanding, I mean, you know, what it is that really makes them tick. I mean, the it was very interesting. There's a book that I just finished, and we'll be interviewing the author, James Tooley, who wrote The Beautiful Tree. And it's all about basically, you know, low cost for-profit schools in the slums of places like India and Kenya and all of that sort of stuff. But one of the points that he makes is, you know, the importance of brands, like among the poor and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, education is desperately trying to figure out how to, you know, get students engaged. And it's really simple. You have to make learning cool. You have to make it so that knowing things is a sign of social status.
Oh, certainly. Yeah. I mean, just as much as what you wear and what you drive, what you know is a signal of who you are.
Right. Do you see that happening, or do we still have a long way to go for that stuff, Jenna?
No, I definitely do. I think the web is the new car, or it's the new clothes. Our social media sites are the way that we showcase ourselves to the world. You know, it used to be MySpace, and we had our song on there, and we had, you know, our background, and we can't customize it as much as we used to. But it's really, you know, our doorstep to the world. It's the way that people see us. And so social currency is important. You know, it's only one of the six things that I talk about in the framework, but it's definitely one that's quite important.
Hmm. And so in terms of, the next step is ease for emotion, right?
Yes. Sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, so elaborate, please.
Tell us your secrets, sir.
When we think about emotion, I think we tend to think about positive and negative. We tend to think about good things, things that make us feel good. You know, we get promoted, our team wins, our kid does well in school, something good happens, or something negative. You know, we get fired, our kid does badly in school, our team loses. And you might think that you share positive things and you avoid sharing negative ones. You know, you share positive things to look good and make others feel good, and negative ones not to. But there's actually another important dimension that emotions differ on, and that's the arousal tendency, or the activation that they're associated with. So some emotions like anger are activating emotions, while other emotions like sadness are deactivating. If you think about what you want to do when you're angry, you want to throw something, you want to yell at somebody, you want to do something. When we're sad, we're deactivated. We don't want to do very much. And so we find in our research is to get people to share, you have to find those high arousal emotions, whether positive or negative. So on the positive side, why do so many funny things get shared? Well, humor is a high arousal emotion. Makes us laugh, drives us to take action, drives us to pass things on. But it also explains why negative things like anger and anxiety get shared. The more physiologically aroused we are, the more activated, the more our blood is pumping, the more our pulse is quickening, the more likely we're to share something.
Well, we also, I think when something bad happens, we want support. We reach out for support, right? I mean, you want to get close to people.
But it's also, I think, you got to discern what kind of bad, right? Because if you just feel sad and depressed, it doesn't necessarily make you reach out. It may make you more introverted. But if you're angry about it, and it's like, look at this shitty thing that happened to me, then you go onto Facebook and you like, you know.
I don't do that. That always annoys me.
Well, exactly. I think that's also, I mean, that was something that I was going to ask earlier, which I think is interesting, is in terms of that 7% figure, if that is the right number, you know, we...
As in people who we only share information, 7% is on social media.
Yeah, I think that increasingly, just as, you know, after, listen, in the 50s or in the 30s, people may have been more susceptible to advertising messages, but now, you know, we're all much more inured to them. I think in the same way, social media no longer has the same power power it does. It used to. I mean, it used to be that, you know, somebody posted a baby photo on Facebook and it was just the biggest thing, or somebody had their angry rant and everybody felt the need to weigh in. And now it's like, angry rant, like,
well, but
baby
I think,
photo.
Jonah, don't you, wouldn't you say it's actually what we're looking for is something that's authentic, something we can believe in. The problem with being inundated with all these messages is you don't know what to believe. But like you were saying, if we actually trust the message, and a lot of times that comes from word of mouth, that's the direction we're going to head in.
Yeah, we definitely trust our friends, our colleagues, our social ties more than we trust people that we don't know. But I think, as you guys are pointing out, you know, the other issue with online is it's just a much more busy channel than it used to be. You know, when we used to have 10 or 15 friends on Facebook, or even 30 or even 100, you know, we could keep up with people. Most things we posted, people would see. It was the first time someone got really angry. You know, everyone would comment on it and make the person feel better. Now, you know, we're connected to thousands of people. Most people don't see most things we post. Even if they do, so many of the things that people post now look very similar. So, you know, it's yet another baby photo, or it's yet another, you know, clickbait headline where people are encouraged to, you know, go after clicking, whatever it is. You know, the most amazing thing, you'll never believe what happened next. Once you've clicked on, you know, 5 or 10 of those and you realize, well, I actually do believe what happened next, that wasn't really that surprising, you're not going to be fooled again. And so I think the channels online, at least, have gotten much busier than they have been before, and the power of offline word of mouth has increased in its value.
Well, you know, then again, there's when Kim Kardashian oils up her cheeks and poses, that picture was talked about by everybody. It's so funny how we just, certain things just no matter what, cut through all the noise, man. You're like, hey, wait a minute, why does that picture bring me to my knees? I'm a married man. I didn't know I was that much of a creep, you know. So I'm always impressed with people who can actually come up with something. I mean, sex, if packaged the right way, still very much sells. It's just interesting.
Yeah, and she did, you know, she did figure out a way to do something different. And I think, you know, we all laugh at Kim Kardashian. I think she's done an amazing job, though, of never producing anything, yet staying in the public eye for so long. You know, she has a television show essentially because she's famous. She gets in the press because she's famous already. But she's parlayed that into more and more things over time just by being famous. Because I think talking about, you know, what's tasty, what appeals to people, she understands how to make content, whether it's releasing photos or doing a television show that resonates with people and will be successful.
Well, I mean, that is something I feel like that example, though, might be a little bit different than what you talk about in Contagious, in terms of it. There's a lot of negative connotation that goes, people like to, it's like Paris Hilton as well. It was the same kind of thing. Like, she really hasn't done anything,
but it's the
but
same
she's
thing
famous
as,
and people talk about her.
But
you
it's
know?
The same thing as you know, there's the classic Barnum and Bailey quote or whatever P.T. Barnum said. He said, you know, that people who, you know, would come to his show and, you know, think that, you know, whatever it was, the mermaid was real, would come once. But the people who thought that it was fake would come twice, because they would come once to see it and say how fake it was, and then they'd come back and bring all their friends to show how fake it was. So
I guess it's the same idea, right?
Yeah.
Right, Jonah? Professor?
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, no, I like that point a lot, and I think, you know, part of it is, you know, we like railing against things. We like, you know, saying, oh, that's terrible, oh, I hate this, because it helps us express who we are. And so, you know, hating Kim Kardashian or making fun of Kim Kardashian is a way for us to bond together.
But let me ask you something. Isn't that more of a, sorry to be politically incorrect, isn't that more of a female compulsion than a male thing? I find women tend to gossip more than men. I just do. And I'm sorry if that sounds politically incorrect. I truly believe that in my heart. So I hope everybody, you politically correct army, you can come at me as much as you want. I think from my experience, it feels as though women tend to enjoy gossip more than men do.
So there's a little bit of data, you know, we think women may talk more than men. There's a little bit of data that suggests that's not really the case. Women don't talk that much more than men. But people definitely talk about different things. You know, women's social relationships are certainly more important to women than they are to men. And so women may talk about them more because they care about them. It doesn't mean that men don't gossip. I think men, you know, talk just as much about other things and talk for the same motivations as women, though what they talk about may differ.
Yeah, that's true. Men like to go bad on on sports figures. They like to kind of talk about, you know, the quarterback that dropped the ball, you know.
Well, isn't, I mean, a lot of this also comes back to Robin Dunbar's work. You know, I mean, another favorite book of all time, Grooming Gossip and the Evolution of Language. Men use language a lot to leck, basically to show off. And to say, like, I'm so smart, look at me, let me hold forth. This is
You mean like me when I dropped Jonah Berger's name and his book? I can't wait. Wait to steal all your ideas, Professor.
As long as I can steal a couple of your jokes, I'm happy.
Listen to me. By the way, if you're in Philadelphia, I'm going to be there December 10th, 11th, 12th, 13th at Helium Comedy Club. And I will put you on my list and I will roll the red carpet out. You can bring whoever you want. I think we're going to sell out pretty quickly, but I promise you I will hold you as many tickets as you need. So you let me know and you have a standing invite. And then I'll take you out for wine or beer and pick your brain just so I can say I hung out with you. you know, so you let me know if you're there.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah, 100%. Are you in Philly?
Usually I am. I'm not there at the moment. I'm spending a little bit of time in New York City, but usually I'm based in Philly, yeah.
Great. And you're back, you know, it's funny because I think you started out, you wanted to be a doctor, didn't you? You went to medical school. You talk a little bit about that in the book.
You know, I started out being a hard scientist. You know, whether we think about material science, math, engineering, computer science, you know, I studied very statistical sort of oriented tools, experimentation, but I thought it was interesting to apply those same rich tools to understanding how people behave. Again, you know, I think sometimes we say, oh, yeah, you know, we can understand how molecules work, but people, we're so complicated, there are no rules that underlie human behavior. And just like anything else, there are rules. They may be more complicated rules. They may be more difficult to capture and understand, but they're rules nonetheless.
There's also been a real change in how we look for those rules. I mean, if you look at sort of, you know, B.F. Skinner, there was this very sort of Pavlovian stimulus response approach that was used. And now there's much more of an awareness of the intersection of emotion and, you know, reason, that the two are really going hand in hand.
Definitely. And I think, you know, the idea of the six, and we talked a little about triggers already, but the idea of triggers is, I think, one of the ones that people use the least. You know, just the fact that something is top of mind, just the fact that we're thinking about something is going to change our behavior. So, you know, I love to say, you know, if I said peanut butter and, what word might you be thinking of?
Jelly,
right? So peanut butter reminds us of jelly.
Or balls. Sorry, but that's just me. Sorry, Professor. Keep going. I'm 10 years old.
If I said rum and, you might think of what?
Coke.
Rum and
Coke.
Yeah. And so peanut butter is almost like a little advertisement for jelly. Even though peanut butter's not around, it reminds us of jelly. That's how we work. You know, we see one thing, we hear one thing, we think about something else. The environment we're in changes what comes to mind. We did a study a few years ago. We looked at whether where people vote could affect how they vote. So we looked at people that voted in different locations. Some people voted churches, some voted schools, some voted firehouses. And you would say, well, it shouldn't affect where they vote. I mean, they just drop off their ballot wherever they happen to be assigned. But if you think about it, voting at a church might change what comes to mind compared to voting at a school, and that's what we found. So, you know, voting at a school increased the likelihood that people supported school funding, in part because it triggered different things in their mind.
God, man.
You know, what we buy, how we vote, what we talk about all depends on the things we're thinking about and what's top of mind.
Can you tell the Kit Kat story? Because that's a great example of triggers, and I thought was so fantastic.
Yeah, I think, you know, I'll tell another one. If you don't mind, I'll tell one that I think we can all relate to, but just the one of reusable grocery bags, right? So if you think about it, we all have reusable grocery bags at home, right? Everybody has them, but most of us don't use them every time to go to the grocery store. And if we think about it, when do we think about the bag? Think about it when we get to the store, right?
Yeah,
when it's too late. We get to the store, we go, oh, I forgot my bags. It's too late. Yeah. And so it's triggered, but it's at the wrong point in time, right? And so the question is, you know, what makes it come to mind? With Kit Kat, you know, people liked Kit Kat, but they weren't buying it. So they just came up with a simple slogan, Kit Kat and coffee, a break's best friend. You know, thinking about coffee, think about Kit Kat. Having a coffee, have a Kit Kat.
Association.
Coffee, Kit Kat.
Yeah.
Yeah, simple association. But now then, when we see the coffee, we're more likely to think about Kit Kat, right? Just like when you think about peanut butter, you think of jelly. And so by linking themselves to coffee, sales increased from about, I think, 300 million to around 500 million just because they got people thinking about it more often. And so it's not just do we like something, but are we thinking about it or not in the first place?
This is this can also be dangerous information. You know, I think about people like yourself, and I really appreciate, you just sound like such a, you know, a mild-mannered, kind man, but you're very ambitious. You know, your thoughts are going to have an effect and already are having an effect on how we live our lives. And people like you, what I love about this podcast, thank you, Hunter Motz, for booking people like Jonah Berger, is I get to talk to people that really are having an effect on the world. And I think that this kind of information, of course, could be used for, I guess, you know, to manipulate a group of people. But at the end of the day, it does make the world a better place. At the end of the day, we're learning how to get important messages out there and get people talking about them. And so I'm saluting you verbally, sir. I'm saluting
you. Well, thank you. Yeah. I appreciate
it. It must
that.
Be very satisfying for you. I think about this when you're just a man and you say, well, I'm going to go out there and try to find the answers to something. And then you do. That's got to, I mean, that moment when you kind of said, I think I'm really on to something must have been, was it a slow process or was there a eureka moment?
You know, first of all, I should bring you with me everywhere I go. You're like the best promoter. You're fantastic. I really appreciate it.
Well,
thank you.
I think you deserve it. I do. I think we live in a culture that celebrates symmetry and muscle and the loudest, sparkliest thing on the centerpiece, the tyrannical centerpiece or whatever. I don't think people like you get your due, so that's why this podcast is important to me. That's why I get it out there. I mean, I just think some of these great ideas that are stuck in books need to get out there, and I know they are getting out there, but that's kind of – so I will. I'll just come around. I'll blow a trumpet every time you
want. Brian will be your hit man.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Professor Jonah Berger, and I'll just release doves and have some people blow some horns, and then you just walk in with a cape.
Yeah.
You know, but I want to take that exact phrase you said, and that's the reason I wrote the book, right? Being an academic is fun. I like research. I like trying to answer puzzles. But it's the most fun when you help people. You know, if at the end of the day you do a lot of research, but no one ever reads it and no one ever uses it, it's not very useful. Mm. And so the reason I wrote Contagious was really to get these ideas out there. You know, there are lots of great research that I and others have done for, you know, decades now in this space, but people haven't really applied them. You know, people, it's so easy to jump on the social media bandwagon or follow some social media guru, and there wasn't really anything out there that people could follow to figure out how to get more word of mouth. And so, you know, do I think we've solved everything? Definitely not. There's much more out there to learn. But I think we've learned some things, and I think this is a useful toolkit to help people to get their stuff to catch on.
Well, before we let you go, what are you working on now? I'm curious.
Oh, wow. So all sorts of new research. So we've done some stuff about, you know, what drives online sharing versus offline sharing. What changes when people talk to large groups versus small groups. But also doing a lot of speaking and consulting, helping companies apply these ideas. So got the opportunity to work with the Gates Foundation and help them with some development messaging. I've worked with, you know, large companies like Google or LinkedIn or Coca-Cola to help them think about how to use these ideas. So, you know, whether it's nonprofits or for-profits, really helping people figure how to get their message out there and get the good stuff to catch on.
Fantastic, man.
And there's, I mean, in terms of the development stuff, I mean, there's been some really interesting stuff that's been done with embedding health messages in soap operas and, you know, things like that, right?
Certainly, and exactly what you were talking about before, less about the information and more about the identity, mm-hmm. more about the emotion, less about this is a bad thing, let me tell you why, but more of a how will people see you if you do this? Mm-hmm. You know, I think so much of health behavior is about stigma. I've been doing some work with the mental health community. You know, so much of it is people think they're the only one, and so they don't want to talk about it. Lots of people have these issues, but because they're private, they're hard to see. How can we make them more observable and make people more comfortable talking about them?
Right. Mm. And I mean, that's the next step, which we didn't get to, but public, right? I mean, in terms of Movember is such a great example of that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, fantastic example. Or the Ice Bucket Challenge, right? Taking a private act, donating money, nobody can see that, supporting a cause, nobody can see it, and make it more public, more observable, because the easier something is to see, the easier it's going to be to imitate.
Mm. Well, and that's what was so smart about the Ice Bucket Challenge is that you make it visible in a way that people don't have to be bragging about it.
Right. The mere fact that someone asked you to do it is now in front of everybody else. You're posting mm-hmm. online. Other people can see it. They might have thought it was ridiculous. But if other people are doing it, they're going to do it, too.
Yeah, I did it. I got challenged, and I did it. I got challenged by, I got challenged by one of my favorite MMA fighters, Donald Cerrone, Donald Cowboy Cerrone. I was like, I'm doing whatever that guy tells me to do.
Yeah.
I was like, that's going to happen. I didn't even know what it was.
But, Brian, you also do the Ice Bucket Challenge after every workout.
I do.
It's the
I
only
do,
way
Hunter.
You can cool down.
That's all I care about. That's right, because I burn. I run hot. I run hot, Jonah. I run hot.
Professor Berger, thank you so much.
Thank you for your work, sir. I insist you come to my show if you're in town. And if you guys want to come December 10th, 11th, 12th, 13th, Helium Comedy Club, and you might just be rubbing elbows with a genius, Dr. Jonah Berger from Wharton School of Business, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for taking time. Happy Thanksgiving. Go back to your family, and you are very appreciated.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Take care. A good man, a smart man, a man who makes a difference, ladies and gentlemen, and we bring you leaders of thought in all fields here at the Brian Callen Show. Who are you again? The Hunter Motz. Hunter Motz, the man who booked this. Thanks for doing all the work, Hunter. We're going to get some comics on here, by the way.
I'm excited.
We're going to get Bill Burr. We're going to get Al Madrigal. We're going to get some people out here.
The John Lovitz, John Lovitz podcast was one of my favorite of all time.
So funny. Let's get him back. Let's get Harlan Williams back.
Sounds
let's get
good
some
to
comics
me.
Back too. In fact, let's get comics involved in the discussion.
I agree.
So that they can interrupt everything and we can learn nothing.
But well, listen, I mean, you know, the thing that I kept on thinking about through this whole thing was Dane Cook, right? I mean, Dane Cook, like so much of how he became successful was getting 1 million MySpace followers,
yeah.
Right?
Dane was the first guy to do it. I mean, people don't give Dane his due. First of all, you know, I say this a lot, and I've said this to Dane, and I've said this to, you know, people. Dane, what got Dane famous was also the fact that he was painfully funny. And I don't care what anybody says. It was always fun to kick him about and stuff. And let me tell you something, man. If you had seen Dane Cook, and you had seen the comedy that got him where he got, you would have been crying. I saw that dude destroy rooms. I mean destroy rooms. I saw Dane is one of the guys, Dane and Joe Rogan, Dane was one of the guys that got me back into comedy. I saw him at Dublin's 10 years ago. Literally, I mean, it was like somebody dropped a bomb. I've never seen people explode with laughter. And he did it for about 45 minutes. I went, oh, I got to do that. I want that right there. And he was killing me. So, you know, and then on top of that, what happened with Dane was he started getting emails. And he started answering those emails. And he said to himself, you know what, man? Because I've talked to him about this. He said, if I answer every single email and I create a list, I can start actually developing a network here.
Mm-hmm.
Kevin Hart did the same thing. Kevin Hart literally said, I'm going to do what Dane Cook does. And he went around after his shows and he was playing for not a lot of money. And he just would get people's emails. And he was so funny. Here's the difference. Both Dane and you got to be funny if you're going to do this. You got to have a product people want to come back and laugh at. But and that's part of what I think we need to stress is that in this book, yes, you know, you have to have things that catch on. There's a technique to it. You got to have the product too.
But I think that so often, I mean, the other message is overemphasized that like, oh, I'm going to create this amazing product and then it will sell itself.
Yes. You know, for me, we were talking about this. Now I'm starting to see a real uptick in ticket sales. It was just, you know, I'm selling out, which I didn't know was going to happen. But I think I've been doing stand-up for so long and I think I have a good product. I think I get it out there. But also with the momentum, with podcasting and tweeting and Instagram and all these things, you kind of get to a point where it reaches a boiling point where there is an exponential growth to things. And some of it is just also you got to remember if you're trying to accomplish something, and a lot of young people listen to this podcast, you know, there are no shortcuts. It does take, just be patient, man, and just keep doing the work. And a lot of times you're going to feel like you're doing the work for no reason. There are a lot of times when I all these podcasts, people were making fun of me. And they're like, you know, you got the 10-minute podcast, The Fighter and the Kid, and then this podcast, and you're wasting a lot of time. Well, no, I'm not. First of all, this podcast, I have so much fun talking to people that I, you know, we were talking about having comedians, a round table of comedians talk with people like Jonah Berger. I don't know. The problem is I want to hear Jonah Berger.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm so fascinated with what he has to say that sometimes the humor might get in the way. But blah, blah, blah. The point is that, you know, I think when you're trying to get somewhere and you're trying to get your message out there, do the work, keep your head down, do the work, and be smart about how you do it. And then you can apply. Make sure you have a product, and then you can apply the lessons that someone like Jonah Berger spent so much time coming up with.
Yeah, but I think that's the shortcut is that Jonah Berger has spent decades thinking about this. There's a whole body of research that he's drawing on even before him. So, you know, there are a lot of these problems have really already been solved in some sense.
Yeah.
And very often people are, you know, chained to a desk trying to figure out these things on their own. And if you go out and you read the right books, you find that the answers that you need are already there.
Well, you said two really cool things this morning when we were talking. Is one is that there are answers. The mm-hmm. answers are out there. They are. And, you know, you and I are working on this TV show, which the idea of being that there is, no, we won't say anything, but there is an answer. There is an answer. And I really love that because it's very easy to be cynical. Mm-hmm. And it's very easy to say, yeah, but what is the answer? Everybody has a point of view. No, there is an answer out there. And if you give in to the fact that there isn't an answer, well, it all depends. First of all, it's very easy to do. Second of all, I don't think it solves a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's also maybe even a little dangerous. You've got to fight for the answer. It is out there. And the other thing you said is that everybody's religious. You know, because we were talking about how people change when you appeal to their emotions. We are emotional creatures. And there are two camps. There's the religious camp and the science camp. The science camp likes to believe that they are the ones that have all the answers because, you know, they're rational. When in fact, everybody is religious in one way or another, and you defined it in very interesting terms where you said, you know, whether you're talking to Lawrence Krauss, who's a great physicist, you know, Lawrence Krauss would never say he was religious. But Lawrence Krauss's religion in some ways is to say, look, I'm a scientist. I have measurable data, and he's right, and God bless him for all his work, and he does a great job. But Lawrence Krauss would probably believe that if everybody thought the way I did— we'd be fine. We'd be great. And any religious person feels the same way. Muslim fundamentalists say if the world were like us, it would finally be a beautiful place to live. Christian fundamentalists are the same way, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I'm that way. For Christ's sake, I'm that way all the time. I do wish people, I often go to bed thinking, God, I'd love to be the emperor of the world because I would solve all the problems. We're all that way. Guess who else is that way? Hillary Clinton. That's why my father thinks she's the Antichrist. And Michael Malice calls her, you know, everybody's mother-in-law. Okay, so the point is.
Yeah, but I you know, I mean, and this is in terms of, you know, what Jonah Berger represents and really what's been happening in neuroscience and psychology, there's been a real shift where, you know, people like Daniel Kahneman, Antonio Damasio, and Hannah Damasio, and, you know, Jonathan Haidt, we now understand that we don't think our way to decisions. We feel our way to decisions. And there's this rationalist delusion that there's such a thing as pure reason. And pure reason is not something that is possible for human beings. As Kahneman says in his book, Thinking Fast and Slow, you know, human beings are not well described by the rational agent model. Like, it's a nice idea to think that we are purely rational, but it's just not possible.
You're certainly raised that way. I was. Yeah. Emotion was considered, well, weakness in a way.
Exactly.
I mean, that's where the Greeks, I mean, look at Socrates and Aristotle. It was about reason.
That's right.
Don't take the path to Jerusalem. Take the path to Athens. You know, it's not faith. It's reason. That's very important.
It's a thousands and thousands year old prejudice in Western culture.
Until you lose a child and then come up to somebody who lost a child and say, you know, this meant nothing.
Well,
there's reason involved in this. I don't know.
The interesting thing is that there's, you know, what Damasio's work shows is that there's always an emotion involved. And very often the emotion that has been associated with science is arrogance and a sort of contempt for people and all of those sorts of things. And so when you look at, I mean, you know, Thomas Woods makes a big thing in his book, one of his books, I don't remember, but about how.
One of his 12 books.
And one of his 12 million books.
Hey, Tom Woods, calm down. Calm down already. Jesus.
But, you know, he talks about some Greek philosopher who, after his children die, all of his children are killed. And, you know, he's just sort of very dismissive about the thing, unmoved by it and all of that sort of stuff.
Yeah, stoic.
Stoic, exactly. But you have to understand that stoicism, that's not pure reason. That's a particular emotional state.
That's denialism.
Or whatever it is. Yeah. But, you know, the...
I don't want to live in that world.
Well, exactly. And I mean, you know, or Robert McNamara, right, who, you know, has all of these data, all of these statistics that he's using to try and figure out how to win the Vietnam War. In the fog of war, he says, oh, you know, what was missing was empathy.
Mm.
We'd failed to understand that they thought they were fighting a war of independence.
God damn.
And so
it's so amazing how sometimes the answers are very simple and they're very human.
100%. And it's not to say, I mean, this for you know, part of that the Platonic idea of Plato is that, there is a battle, there is an endless war raging within you between reason and emotion. And we now know that there's no battle. They work hand in hand. And then the challenge is to figure out how to make them work most effectively. Reason has done amazing things for us, and so has emotion. And there are some things that reason can see clearly, for example, statistics and everything that has made science possible and, you know, empiricism. But there are also some things that emotion can see clearly that data cannot. For all of his data, Robert McNamara could not see the thing that really mattered about the Vietnam War.
God damn. I like that. I wish I had said that.
Well, Brian.
Son of a bitch. Maybe I'll dub my voice over yours. It'd be kind of creepy and weird.
But when you
How do... How come we don't have video? Well, hey, Rena, where's the video on this? I mean, what the hell? We need to be able to see our brains at work.
Well, you mean MRIs?
Yes! Let's get some MRI action.
Well, Brian, do me a favor, though, and this is just a shout-out and an acknowledgement to all the people on Twitter. When you do dub me over, take out all the you knows and the likes and the rights.
I know, you've gotten some emails about that. You got one guy who's like, hey, bro, stop using the you knows and the likes.
Yeah,
and,
it's a well, that, horrible verbal tick.
You say this, you go, well, that's the interesting thing.
You know. Oh, my God. Yeah.
And that's, I always used to say from doing Joe Rogan's podcast, I would always be like, by the way. And now they all say that. I got to get you on Rogan's podcast. I'm going to call him right now. Ladies and gentlemen, December 10th, 11th, 12th, 13th, Philly, Helium Comedy Club. Come see me. Oh, I'm going to invite Adam Grant, too.
Hopefully
I can get Berger and Grant to my show.
Jackpot.
Get them together.
Yeah. Or just the whole Wharton faculty.
Oh, I'd love it.
Can you imagine? I mean, that actually, do you think that you would finally earn your father's love?
Oh, man. I tell you what, I promise you I'd make them laugh their ass off. That's a cool thing about being a comic. I don't give a shit how smart you are. I'll make you, I'll shatter your ribs, mofo. Except, that's a fact.
Yeah.
I had 6 shows in San Diego. Sold out. People couldn't even get in. It was such a good feeling. So anybody in San Diego, thank you for coming out. You guys were incredible. What incredible crowds. And Ontario, my God, the Inland Empire. I love those crowds, man. I don't know what it is. Working class motherfuckers. Just muscular people out there. Heavy. Some people are heavy. Some people are muscular. And they just work. You can see that they just, whatever it is, they earn their money. And they come to laugh. They are so rowdy and wonderful.
Brian, have you ever considered that while you might not be the emperor of the world, you might be the emperor of the Inland Empire?
Yes! Yes, good people out there.
Ontario is your kingdom.
Good people in Ontario, man. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.